You're listening to Irish Radio Canada, Home and Abroad, and this week we're going to hear about the British Isles Family History Conference, the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa Annual Conference, which is coming up at the end of the month, the 26th, 27th of October. Mary Lou Simak is here with me. Mary Lou is heavily involved in coordinating and getting some of the wonderful expert presenters involved. Well, Mary Lou, thanks a million for coming back. And I should say, by the way, it is a celebration of Irish family history this year. Mary Lou, welcome.
Thank you very much, Austin.
Big year, the 30th anniversary.
Yes, it is. Yes, it certainly is. Yes, the founding meeting for BFISCO, the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa, was held on October 19th, 1994, which is almost 30 years ago.
And this year is virtual 100%. Like, I know COVID presented challenges, but it also presented tremendous opportunities.
Yes, that's for sure. And with our 30th anniversary conference this year, it's all virtual. So it's on the Zoom platform, and it's enabling us to get 19 experts from Ireland, Northern Ireland, online for our conference. When we had in-person conferences, we could only afford to bring over one speaker from Ireland. So we're saving a lot of money this way. It's less costly to run. And the benefit is that we can bring in people from Ireland, and that participants from all over the world can be part of the conference as well.
And I guess it means that rather than the expense that might be involved in having to rent a property and all the rest, it means you can probably allow more affordable registration.
Absolutely, yes. So the registration for members of the society is $35, and for non-members of the society, it's $50.
We're going to hear from the speakers, and you and I will have a little bit of chat after and find out a little bit more detail. You're listening to Irish Radio Canada Home and Abroad, and we are talking this week about the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa Annual Conference, which is coming up the weekend of the 25th, 6th, 7th of October. And on Saturday, the 26th, there's a session 9:15 to 10:30, researching farming ancestors in Ireland. And that will be with William Ralston. William's holds a PhD in archaeology from Queen's University in Belfast, and he began working for the Ulster Historical Foundation in 1997 and has been its research director since 2006. He has edited and written a number of publications, and I want to give William as much time as possible. William, thanks a million for coming along, and you can get full details on the BFISCO site. William, thanks a million. Researching farming ancestors in Ireland. What kind of data is available to do something like that? Because I know, I'll go back to my time in banking in Ireland, and I know when someone came in for a loan, they'd bring in the deeds. And the old deeds used to have go way back to God knows when.
Yes. Well, I tell you what, let me start with my own family story. We've been on the same farm now since 1830, and I'm the sixth generation Rolston to have lived on that farm, and my nephews would be now in the seventh generation. So I now live in County Antrim, but I've still a strong affinity with the place I grew up near, well, really on the banks of the River Foyle in County Tyrone. 20 years ago, my father was in at his solicitor's office in Strabane on some routine business, and the solicitor said to him, "I've got this bundle of documents. Would you like to take them away with you? Otherwise, we'll just dispose of them." So my father said, "No, I'll bring the documents home." So we brought the documents home, opened it up, and there inside the bundle was the original lease for the farm from 1835, from the Marquess of Abercorn to Robert Rolston, my three times great grandfather. And so something like that, so unexpected, and yet there it was, waiting for us to discover it, so many decades afterwards. And so you're right, leases, deeds can all help us find out more about our farming ancestors. And one of the main categories of record that I want to talk about in my presentation are records relating to the management of landed estates, because up until the end of the 19th century, even into the early 20th century in many places, Farmers didn't own their land outright. They were tenants on an estate. They paid rent to a landlord. And so it wasn't until the passing of a series of land acts that the farmers actually became proprietors of their lands, actually became the owners of their lands. So before that, if you can find records relating to the management of the estate on which your ancestor lived, you may find huge detail about your farming ancestor. So you may, for example, find rentals recording the rent payments they made. You may find the lease granting them possession of the farm. You may find a map showing you exactly where the farm was located. And the great thing is that the work of archivists over recent decades has meant that many of these estate papers, if they survive, are now available to the public in the likes of the Public Record Office of Northern Ireland in Belfast, or the National Library of Ireland in Dublin, or even in many of the county archives and museums across Ireland. So landed estate papers are hugely important in researching farming ancestors.
So William, given the age we now live in where everything is digital, and even when you do a land transfer, you don't see paperwork left, right or centre, and you don't have to produce the deeds before you used to have to. At some stage in the future, is this going to, does this represent a step backwards rather than a step forward?
With the digitization, yes. Well, you know, with the advance of technology, you know, you just wonder, you know, how are these digital items going to be supported in the future? I'm sure that they will find a way, but at the same time, there's nothing like actually handling the original parchment of the deeds, or even in some cases, you go back even further, the vellum on which the deed has been written. If we think of the Public Record Office now, it's not relating to Ireland, but the oldest document in the Public Record Office in Belfast dates from 1219, and it is still perfectly legible 800 years later. So there's nothing like getting your fingers grubby looking at actual documents in an archive.
And what I mean in a way is that the digital transactions are very clinical. You know, you're not getting, as you just said, you have the vellum, and there's a social history wrapped up in a document in the way that it might be written or phrased, and that you lose when it's simply saying on such and such a date, yep, William Roston became the owner of a piece of property from Austin Cummerton, period.
That's it. You're right. I mean, when you see the original deeds, you'll see your ancestor's signature. There might even be a seal. You'll be able to see the witnesses to it. You might have many leases by the 19th century were printed documents, but with spaces left so that the other details could be filled in. The date, the name of the townland, the extent of the farm, the rent, any other terms and conditions. So you can see where there's something of a negotiation going on. Right. Maybe not so much negotiation. You basically told many cases, take it or leave it. But you see something of the process in a way that a digital record just doesn't give you.
Right. So in that context then, while, as I say, you know, I remember back to my early career when I worked in the Bank of Ireland, and down in the safe, there was these mounds of documents tied up, and because it was the security for the loans. Yeah. Yes. And as you just say now, that, you know, you had the banks, and I think they may have put out a call at one stage and said, if you don't collect your documents by a certain date, they'll be destroyed. I'm sure an awful lot of what would have been very important historic documents were just shredded.
Yes. Yes, I fear so. I mean, there are all sorts of stories of people who simply, you know, lit large fires of records because they had no use for them, or which were maybe pulped as scrap paper, or which were just thrown out, or which are maybe still in attics or vaults just mouldering away. But, you know, let's hope that those such items can still be rescued. Like I mentioned, that the lease, for example, for my three times great grandfather, we never knew that existed. You know, 7 miles from the farm, there was the lease for the property. You never know what you'll find until you start looking. In fact, in that case, we weren't even looking and it came up.
And the other thing, when you mentioned about the estates, I know that some estates kept far more detailed records than others. So for someone like you, if you can get your hands on a well-documented landlord who maintain meticulous records, you've won the lottery.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, yes. I mean, it tends to be the case that the larger the estates, the better managed it was, and the greater volume of records that were generated, but also preserved. And so if you say some of the estate collections in the Public Record Office that I'm familiar with, some of those collections run to tens of thousands of individual items, tens of thousands of individual items, including records going right back to the beginning of the 17th century. So the bigger estates could employ more people to help run it, more records produced, and then they would have proper storage facilities to keep those records safe until, you know, at some point somebody said, maybe you should transfer that to an archive, a proper archive, and those right. records can be preserved.
So, William, then on individual estates, would, when a lease may have expired or ended and somebody may have left and immigrated or something like that, would it be typical or that the landlord may have put an entry why the lease no longer carried?
Yes, that's the great thing about some estate records. You can find like the little annotations or notes to indicate when a family had emigrated. So back in the 18th century in particular, leases were often for lives. In other words, a lease would not expire until a number of individuals named in that lease had died.
Right.
And even if that person had emigrated to America, even if the person designated a life had emigrated to America, the lease was still valid. And so you will find maybe correspondence or maybe notations in rent books to indicate so-and-so is alive in this lease and is living in Philadelphia or Toronto right. or wherever that might be. And right. you might even find correspondence where the landlord has instructed his agent, go and find out if that person is still alive. And the person's maybe had to travel, you know, a couple of hundred miles to somewhere to find out if the person is still alive. So is the lease still valid if the person is alive?
Fascinating. So then the other aspect of it, as you say rightly, you know, if someone went emigrated, stating where it was. But what I guess it would give you as well is if a lease expired or terminated, where that may not have been a condition, it at least gives someone a date where they can possibly check a ship's manifest so as that they've got a date potentially to try and join the dots.
Potentially, yes, potentially. What we often find is that if a lease expired, it didn't automatically mean that the tenant was going to be evicted. They maybe had a new lease issued to them, or they maybe continued as a tenant at will. But yes, many people did emigrate. Many people actually emigrated during the duration of the lease. Mm-hmm. And so then what happened is that they sold, and I say sold in inverted commas because they didn't obviously own the land outright, but sold the right to occupy that farm to an incoming family. And the money that the incoming family paid the outgoing family helped to pay for them to travel across to North America, wherever, and maybe right. to set themselves up in business or a farm out there. And again, you can find information on that in collections of estate papers.
Fantastic. William, we don't want to steal all your thunder. Your session is Saturday, the 26th of October, and that's 9:15 to 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm sure you'll have a Q&A at the end of it, and it is on Zoom. If you head on to bifhsgo.ca, you'll find a tab there for the conference where you can register. It is a virtual conference this year, and we've been chatting with William Ralston. William, thanks so much for taking the time.
Not at all. Thank you, Austin.
You're listening to Irish Radio Canada Home and Abroad. This week we're covering the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa Conference, which is coming up over the weekend of 25, 6, 7 of October. And it's virtual, so you go to bifhsgo.ca for details. And Mark McDowell, he has a BA a degree in Modern and Ancient History, as well as a further and adult education teaching certificate. His lifelong interest in local history and family history was reignited after he got his first DNA test in 2012, and I can relate to that. And he's an education officer of the North of Ireland Family History Society, the DNA officer on the executive committee of the Family History Federation, and a co-administrator of FTDNA North of Ireland Project. And he has been a speaker for Legacy Family Tree Webinars and Genetic Genealogy Ireland. And the goal of his talks is to make DNA research understandable to the average person, and to encourage more, that's going to be an interesting one, and to encourage more people to embrace the rewards of DNA testing. And Martin's session is on Saturday, the 26th of October, 10:45 a.m. Eastern Time. And it is using DNA in the North of Ireland. Martin, welcome.
Thank you, Austin, and thank you for the very thorough introduction.
I'm going to throw you straight in at the deep end.
Okay.
I've done my Y DNA, and I'm at North of Ireland lineage, Belfast, and I found out nothing.
Okay. Well, that is unusual, I would say. There is three different types of DNA tests, just for your listeners. There is a Y test, there's mitochondrial test, and there's autosomal DNA test. Now, your Y test traces your male line back over 24 generations. Can I ask you what level of Y test you did?
37, I think.
37, that's the problem. That's why you haven't got much out of it, because there's three different levels of a Y test. There's Y37, 111, and the big Y700. And it's like everything else. You don't use a mobile phone from the 1990s because they would just be laughed at today. Well, your 37 test is still viable, but it's not sufficient by today's standards. What you should be doing is upgrading that test to the big Y. And there's a lot of interpretation and new information available to you if you do that. So you would get information on migration patterns. You would get information on unique mutations that occurred in your direct ancestors. And you don't get that with a Y37 test. But it can be upgraded. You don't need to retest. You just need to contact FTDNA, pay the difference between the two tests, and they will upgrade the test for you.
But Martin, is not all this dependent upon others in my lineage having provided their DNA so as that there's a comparative database?
It is, of course, but the advantage of Y-DNA testing is that because the test goes so far back, you're not relying on a small group of testers who are very closely related to you to test. You're actually looking at a larger community that's going back over 24 generations, and you do get some information that goes thousands of years back and even tens of thousands of years back. And one of the things they also give you now is connections to ancient remains that have been found through an archaeology dig. And also they would give you notable connections to famous people such as Beethoven, or even some of the cast of Friends are on there as well. So you can find your connections to a wide group of people. And that just makes DNA slightly more fun. But all of that's available through the big Y test.
So did what I threw at you help in a way cover what your topic is going to be about?
Yes. So what I'm going to be talking about is how we use DNA in the North of Ireland. And what we do use is a three-tier approach towards all of the different types of tests. In a lot of people's minds, there's just a DNA test, and it's probably ancestry that they have heard of. And that's only an autosomal DNA test. That's only one bit of the picture, and that's not sufficient if you're wanting to do a test. Just the same as I said to you, a Y37 isn't sufficient. You have to consider what questions you have and how best to get that information out of your DNA. And we're very good at doing this in Northern Ireland, probably because of the lack of records we have because of the fire in the forecourts. So a lot of Irish records from the 1700s have been lost, and what we're able to do now is to reconstruct family trees based on DNA alone. So we're actually getting back beyond the paper records, and we've established techniques for doing this, and this is helping us to move forward. So one of my duties, you mentioned that I worked for the Family History Federation. So we're trying to expand some of this work into England, Scotland and Wales, and try to let them learn by what we have actually accomplished. And just to give you one more idea on that, we do geographical DNA projects where we raise money. We have fundraising going on, we buy DNA kits, and we thoroughly test within a parish. And we test people who would never do a DNA test in their lives. So what we're doing is building up the database. We're finding the connections between people in the community. That's very good for a sense of identity. It also helps people around the world find their roots. And we also then can use that information to build those trees back beyond the current record that exists. So it's an approach that we're using to great effect.
Well, Martin, I don't want to steal your total thunder because otherwise, what's the point? You don't need to go to conference. You got it here. But no, you do need, because I know already from what you and I've said and what I've heard from you is I have so much to learn. And it has been a tremendous learning experience, even in the short few minutes we've had to chat.
And I'm going through with DNA.
Go ahead.
The thing with DNA is that you're always learning. There's always something new coming along, and we try to keep our information fresh so as we can adapt our approach when we need to in order to be effective.
The conference is on 26th, 27th of October. It's a virtual annual conference. You'll get all the details at bifshgo.ca. Registration, etc., will all be there. And we've been chatting with Martin McDowell. Martin's session, as we said, is going to be on Saturday, 26th of October, 10:45 a.m. Eastern Time, using DNA in the North of Ireland. Martin, thanks a million for taking the time.
Thanks very much, Austin.
You're listening to Irish Radio Canada Home and Abroad. And this year, the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa, their annual conference is going to focus on Ireland. And it's cyclical. One year it's Ireland, one year it's Scotland, one year it's Britain, or the UK, or maybe England. I get mixed up on those. But this year is Ireland, and I pay particular attention to that as always. And it's running virtually the 26th, 7th of October, and you can get all the details at bifhsgo.ca. And one of the presenters this year is Claire Bradley, and Claire is based in Dublin, and she's a professional Irish genealogist working with both traditional paper records and genetic genealogy. And she holds a certificate in genealogy from UCD and an MA in history from the family from the University of Limerick. Claire Tafalcheroth, great to have come along, and thanks so much for taking time. What are you going to be talking about?
I'm going to be talking about something that a lot of people need to learn about, which is how to use hints. So when you do a lot of genealogy online, you use the big commercial sites, you know, like Ancestry and MyHeritage and so on. And also on FamilySearch, the Mormon site, they give you these hints and they're suggestions of records or people's family trees that might be relevant for your family tree. And people think, oh, this is great, you know, and I myself had great success with some hints. But a lot of people just think, oh, the computer says this must be right, so it must be right. And they add in the information to their tree and they don't do any analysis of it and they don't verify it. They don't go, hang on, there might be five John Smiths in this town or John Murphys or whatever. And they don't analyze it properly. So I'm going to talk about how to try and avoid some of the pitfalls with these, but also celebrate the great possibilities that come out of these. I've had great finds myself, one of which actually centres on Canada. I discovered by accident through a hint that a set of my own ancestors got married in Quebec.
Right.
Just the beginning of the famine, 1846. I've no idea what they were doing there. I can only presume that they had gone because of the famine. But I had enough information in the record, which was in French, to say this is definitely the right people. And I know that they came back then to Limerick quite quickly because 10 months later, the first child is baptized in Limerick City. So I found this through a hint. And at first I thought, this is nonsense. I have no ancestors in Canada. All of my ancestors are Irish. But no, it's definitely them. And I wouldn't have found it without a hint. So that was an amazing find. And if you see something that's in another country, you have to be even more skeptical because there could be people with the same name, you know, they could look like they're right, but maybe they're not. And when it comes to people's own family trees, the errors can be compounded. So if you've taken a hint and gone, yeah, I think that's right, put it in your tree, somebody else could go, oh, well, this person's got it in their tree, and I think it's right, they think it's right, it's in my tree. And so I found somebody in my family tree, and there's 17 different trees there on one of the sites that says he was a coal miner and that he went to America. And it's not him at all. They right. merged right. people who had the same name. And it was somebody who had the same name who left on a boat from Liverpool. Yeah. And the other person was actually from Liverpool.
Right.
And leaving on a boat from Liverpool doesn't mean you were from Liverpool, of course. And they've merged those two people together, and all these people think they have the right thing, and they don't at all. They're all right. wrong. So there's a lot to learn in that. And I just thought, you know, particularly if you're just starting off in genealogy, it's really good to understand that at the start. The potential of it, but also the pitfalls.
Yeah, I'm a genealogical dabbler.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say there's a lot of people like me. We dabble.
Absolutely.
And I use WikiTree.
Yes.
And the reason I chose WikiTree was because, well, it was free. But it also throws up hints.
Yeah, but WikiTree throws up hints too. And it also tries very hard to combat against errors by asking people to be very careful with sourcing. But perhaps for a beginner, sometimes WikiTree might be put off because there's a learning curve in it.
Right.
As well.
Yeah, I didn't. I eventually found out to it. But one of the other things, like I'm in a unique situation in some ways in that my family name is rather unique.
Yes.
And there aren't that many of us. But when I get onto my mother's side, my mother was an O'Sullivan.
Oh.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I feel your pain. And
her mother was a Kavanagh.
Right. Very common names. Yeah.
So while I've actually hit stone walls with the Comertons, I guess I've found myself in a mire.
Yeah.
With the O'Sullivans and the Cavanaghs.
Absolutely. I mean, if you get Sullivan down in Cork or Kerry, you can really get stuck very quickly because there's just so many of them, and they all have the same names, the same first names, and they use branch surnames with Sullivan. So people be called like O'Sullivan Rua or something, but the Rua bit wouldn't be in the records. It'd just be no. oral. And you wouldn't know that as someone coming from the outside. And that's where the oral history comes in invaluable, like if there's any actual knowledge in the family of that sort of thing. But if there's not, if there's a knowledge gap, you can really get stuck with those common names. Like I have Riley ancestors and I have no idea where they came from. My granny said they were from Yall, but she's wrong. I've looked. They're definitely not from Yall. And they're in Dublin, and they must have come from somewhere for her to think that, and probably Cork for her to think that. But there's nothing to go on. You know, so even professional can get stuck.
Yeah. Well, the other one is my mother always said we were a Sullivan Bear. But you get to a certain point, and what I've discovered is that because the civic records in Ireland really only start in, what, 1859, 1860?
54, yeah.
Yeah. You're relying then on parish records, but you need to know the parish.
You do, yeah. And it has to have survived, or for them to have been keeping records. If you've got someone from, say, up in Donegal, a lot of the parish records in Donegal only get going after the civil registration. So they're no use to you as a going back tool.
Right, right.
They just weren't there. They just didn't have them.
Right.
Lots of them don't start until the 1850s.
Right. So I'm not going to steal your thunder because I'm going to leave you that you can identify what are the things to look out for, what the pitfalls are to watch,
exactly.
What trails might be the ones to follow, and what trails might be the ones not to follow. And we'll have that for the presentation. And your session is on Saturday, the 26th of October. And that is at 12:30 to 1:45 Eastern time.
Yes, and I'm going to be doing a Q&A afterwards on DNA as well.
Brilliant, brilliant. And there's more information available at www.cbgenealogy.ie, which is where you'll find Claire. And again, the conference is the 26th, 7th of October, and that's bifhsgo.ca. Claire Bradley, thanks so much for taking the time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and we've been talking about the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa 2024 conference. And John Grenham
He was the project manager with the Irish Genealogical Project from 1991 to 1995 and later went on to develop and market his own genealogical software. John's Irish Record Finder, and that was Grenham's Irish Record Finder, is the software. And in 2005, he was the first genealogist in residence at Dublin City Library, and he was awarded a fellowship of the Irish Genealogical Research Society in 2007 and of the Genealogical Society of Ireland in 2010. And he's the author of Tracing Your Irish Ancestors, and that's gone to its fifth edition. And a standard reference guide for Irish genealogy, and also the Atlantic Coast of Ireland, 2014, he wrote that, and an illustrated history of Ireland, and that came out in 1997. The Clans and Families of Ireland, 1995, are among John's work. So prolific in every respect. And John will be talking about mapping, as I understand. John, thanks a million for taking the time to come along. I know you and I chatted 14 years ago, and time flies.
Yeah.
Neither of us have aged.
Oh, no. Tune and oak. That's what happened. We both on different sides of the Atlantic. Still tune and oak. Anyway.
So, you're back at the British Isles Family History Conference, and which is focusing on Ireland this year.
Yeah. This is. I'm going to be talking about mapping Ireland's records. One of the things that happened to me, you mentioned the software, that turned into a website with the Irish Times and then my own website, johngrenham.com, and that's been running now more or less since 1998. But in the past, my son has just come into the business with me. Well, not just, he came about 3 years ago. But one of the things it's done has given me a kick up the up and got me moving on things. One of the things that got me moving on was maps. I have developed an obsession with digital mapping. Okay, so for example, if you take a record source like the 1901 census, what I can do now is map surnames, households of a particular surname, onto the local districts where they're recorded in the census, and then do sort of heat sink, showing the number of households of each, and then you can click on them and go straight through to the original records. And I've done that now for all the major record sources, so General Register Office records of births, marriages and deaths, Catholic Parish Registers, the 1901-1911 census, Griffith Valuation, and I'm kind of running out of things to map. Don't stand too still, Austin, or I'll map you.
Okay, well, I'm going to put that back to you because, again, yeah. I have a situation, and this is probably not untypical. I can trace my great-grandfather, and I noticed that there would appear to have been a wedding, and this is in Bula in County Galway. And I know who the bride and the groom are.
Yeah.
But I've no idea the parish the groom came from, and I've no idea where they went. So when you, on your software, or you ask, I've noticed, you can put in the names of a couple, the two names for a wedding, and that you can map it. So for parish records, you actually are for some things, you need to know the parish to start with. And to me, that is the challenge I always come up against.
Well, I mean, the first question I would ask you about that marriage is when it took place, what the approximate date was. Because if it's after 1864, there's a state record of it. And the state record will tell you the exact townland addresses as well as the parish. So that's the first thing. If it's before 1864, probably you can map the Catholic parish marriages. There's a section devoted purely to that, and you can zoom in and then click through. I've done a deal with Find My Past, who have a transcript of the Catholic parish registers, and you click through to any records you want to see on that, and they're free to see. You have to register, but they're free. So it's more okay. Where if a researcher is a window cleaner, is cleaning windows and making things clear, I'm a squeegee maker. I'm not a window cleaner. Okay. I make tools that help people to find things. But It's a hard concept to get through, especially, you know, just talking about it. But it's one of the things, it's this man, Edward Neefsy actually was his name. He published a book about 2002 called Families of Ireland, I think, where he took the telephone directories for Northern Ireland and the Republic and mapped surnames against the prefixes, the dialing prefixes, the local area codes, that's the word, and then produced sort of dot matrix maps showing the concentrations in various areas. And he did that for, the 200 most common surnames in Ireland. And it was the last time you could do it because there are no such things as telephone directories anymore. But I saw this and it really, the light bulb went off in my head. It was just so vivid to see what areas of the country you could see. McMahon, there they are in Monaghan, there they are in Clare. You know, you can actually see the clumps. And that's, I was at that stage with the software providing lists of places.
Right.
But a list is one thing, a picture is another, and picturing these things on maps really makes it leap out at you. So that's basically what I've been doing.
And of course, John, mapping technology has developed tremendously over the last number of years to the point that I know that local authorities use it to map even where all the stop signs are and where the yield signs are.
So in effect,
you're able to use the same type of technology to zone in on what would be names.
Yeah, I mean, it started off with Google Maps. They had this free application programming interface and you could plug into it and use, you know, basically I taught myself to code in order to do it. And as everybody who is self-taught knows, there are giant holes in your knowledge and you fall down them every so often. But then I moved on. There are a couple of other bunches, Mapbox and MapTiler, that do the same thing. They provide access to these open source maps provided by OpenStreetMap, and they let you program, add labels, add borders, add heat sinks. You know, it can become compulsive. There's a website called DublinHeritageMaps.com, which is an object lesson in how obsessive it can become. There's a man there who has mapped all the post boxes in Dublin. He's mapped all the filling stations that sell liquefied gas in Dublin.
Right.
Once you start doing this stuff, it does become compulsive. And I speak from bitter experience, actually from happy experience.
Okay, so if I'm going to come to your session at the conference and I don't want to become compulsive, how are you going to help me without me becoming an addict?
Okay, well, I mean, one of the points about this is to show people, and again, because it's a talk with a presentation, to show people how the maps work and how they can actually shed light on the records, on doing research. And one of the things as well is that there'll be a discount for people attending. There's a soft paywall. People get free five goes in 24 hours, and then they're asked to subscribe or log in, or they can come back in 24 hours and keep going.
Right.
But there'll be a 33% discount for anybody attending. So if they want to try it out, they can do it like that, you know?
Brilliant. So we should then give them some coordinates. Well, first of all, your session is on Sunday, the 27th of October, and that is at 11:15 a.m. Eastern Time and runs till 12:30. And you will then provide all the details at that, but we'll provide them here today as well. And there will, while you give the presentation, I'm sure there's an opportunity for a Q&A.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes.
Indeed. So where should we be directing people other than, first of all, the conference registration, et cetera, is at BIFHHSGO, which is the British Isles Family History Society, Greater Ottawa, .ca, which is the Canadian prefix, and that's to do the registration. And, John, for your own site?
It's johngrenham.com. johngrenham.com. It's very simple.
Thanks, John. It's been tremendous reconnecting with you, and I know it'll be a fantastic conference.
Thank you, Austin.
You're listening to Irish Radio Canada at Home and Abroad, and we're talking about the annual conference of the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa this week. And Natalie Bodle is one of the presenters, and her topic is My Ancestors Were Irish, or Were They? And Natalie is a full-time professional genealogist, educator and author with many years of family history research experience, and she undertakes ancestral research throughout the UK and Ireland, specialising in Irish and Scots-Irish research. And she's a native of County Antrim and has a postgraduate certificate in genealogical studies from the University of Strathclyde, and is a member of the Association of Professional Genealogists, which is also a frequent speaker at local, national and international circuit on Irish genealogy topics. She has a company, Roots Revealed, and that's www.rootsrevealed.co.uk, and she's based in Ballymena, County Antrim. Natalie, thanks a million for coming along and spending a few minutes with us. And my ancestors were Irish, or were they?
Yeah, so I suppose we tend to think very much of the Irish as people who have emigrated, so they left Ireland. But actually, we have quite a rich tapestry of different origins who live in Ireland, and their descendants live in Ireland, who came to Ireland. So we have a range of the Vikings, we have the Normans who came, we have the Scots, of course, you know, the Scots-Irish, the Lowland Scots, we have the Huguenots, the Palatines, and some of the Highland Scots as well, the Galloglasses. So we look at all of those names, and we look at the origins of those people, and look at some of the names and the history of the names. And just looking at that tapestry and all the differences, that's very interesting, because we can assume sometimes that, you know, our families were native Irish, and we get maybe a bit of a surprise when we realise that they maybe weren't. They maybe originated somewhere else entirely.
But, well, I guess in one way, nobody is 100% anything. It just, and yes, I know if you do your DNA, you get the email that tells you we've reassessed your findings, and we find that you're now gone up a percentage or you've gone down a percentage. But the inevitability or the reality of life is that people have been migrant from as long as animals have been traipsing the earth, and people have to follow them to hunt. So where can you draw the line? And by that I mean, you mentioned the Huguenots, the Vikings and all the rest of it, but they weren't doing their DNA.
That's very true. They weren't. And really, those ethnicity estimates that you get from the DNA results, they don't tend to tell you that you were Viking, or that, you know, that you were Viking, unless you had done maybe the Y DNA test, which can be quite useful for that. But of course, you know, that's only one line, and dozens and hundreds of ancestral lines that you actually have. So, yes, you're quite right. We're, most of us are a bit of a mixture of all different types of origins. So it's interesting just to see that. But it's always one of those things that people have an interest in. You know, like, so where does my name come from? You know, what are the origins of it? And as well as that, particularly with Irish research, you'll know, Austin, that it can be quite difficult to tie down, you know, if your ancestors emigrated, it can be difficult to tie down where in Ireland they came from. But sometimes we can use those surnames, you know, our own surname, to help tie down the places where we might have originated, because you get some names that are very peculiar to certain geographical areas. And those names then, so we have tips and tools that we'll look at during the talk, and that can help you then to narrow down maybe where some of those names actually came from, or where they were concentrated. So rather than having to maybe search in 32 counties of Ireland, you know, maybe you only have to search in a couple of parishes. So that can make life a bit easier for you.
So what you'll be covering basically is helping point people in the direction of where they can start digging in order to narrow down the focus. And, you know, and I know we don't have enough time to go into great detail, but one of the things based on what you were saying there that struck me was that, and not wanting to disparage any ethnicity or anything, but you know, within the animal kingdom, I think you have to have a certain number of generations of a dog before you can say it's a purebred. Well, in the context of humans, how many generations do you need to be to before you're purebred Irish?
I don't know, and I think it might be difficult to say. I would doubt that there's too many people could say that they're absolutely 100% purebred native Irish.
So your talk is on Sunday, and that is at 1 to 2:15 p.m. Canadian time. And you can get the details for that at bifhsgo.ca. And if you go on there, you will find a tab for the conference, the 2024 conference. It gives the program, the speakers, registration, all the other details. And in that also, you'll get a tab for the speakers. And you can find links to Natalie's site, which again is rootsrevealed.co.uk. Natalie, it's been great chatting with you, and I'm sure it'll be a fun presentation and great interaction.
Thanks very much, Austin.
You're listening to Irish Radio Candidate Home and Broadmoor, this week talking about the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa and their annual conference, which is coming up towards the end of the month. And this year it is online, and that's on the 26th and the 27th of October. Details at bifhsgo.ca. And as I say, we're talking about the various topics that are being covered at the conference. And one of the topics is the Irish Palatine, an alternative Irish heritage. And the presenter on that is Austin Bovenizer. And Austin grew up in Ireland in a different parallel world. And by that he means that the schools, church and the independence of farming life set his family apart from most of the Irish community. And he'll outline the history of the Irish Palatines, including their journey from Germany to Ireland and the communities that they established in their new homeland, and their role in bringing Methodism to North America. And he'll also provide an insight into the migration of some of the families to Ontario and discuss research resources. And he's a graphic artist and an illustrator by profession. And as a result, he can bring the story to life in more ways to one. And Austin is here with me at the moment. Thanks a million for taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me on. Yeah.
Did I give you anything to talk about, or have I stolen your thunder?
No, not at all. No. I suppose, you know, when I was very young, I didn't notice, you know, that we were very much different than anybody else. Because we were in our own world. We had our own schools, our own church. We didn't really mix very much with people outside our own community. And it was only then as I grew up and you begin to realize you have all these strange names. And in my part of County Limerick, to most people around here, of course, they're just second nature, those names. But to outsiders, they would find them very strange. And you know, when you go out in the world and when you're working and then if you go abroad and where are you from Ireland and what's your name, Austin Bovenizer. I mean, straight away, you know, the first thing that's going to be said to you is that's not an Irish name. So, I was always aware, my father would always mention to us that we came from Germany. And he would always mention that. Actually, where we lived, the nearest house to the area where I lived, there were other Palatine houses around. It was a community. It was a colony originally of little farmers they worked together and they had their own burgomeisters. They had their own meetings and whatever. And as you said there, the farming, of course, kept them independent, completely independent. And it was, you know, it was, I suppose, a strange world. There was no other houses around. We were in a fairly rural area, and it was on actually a little road of its own, which it was a private road when I was young, and had to be maintained by the individuals along that road, which would have originally been called the colonists on that area.
So geographically, Austin, where are you located relative to some of what would be the major landmarks that we might be familiar with in Limerick?
Okay, we're about 20 miles from Limerick City. We're on just off the N21. We're between Rathkeel and Newcastle West, and the Killeheen, where I live, is actually part of Arda, the village of Arda. And lots of people might have heard of the Arda Chalice. So the Arda Chalice was found in Arda, so that's how it got its name. So our address is Arda, but of course, our colony, our area was part of the Suddle or Southwell estate. Thomas Suddle lived at Castle Matrix or Castle Matrix, and he invited the people onto his land because he was interested in starting a linen industry. He was interested in bettering his estate, and he knew the Palatines had skills with weaving and growing flax and so forth. So he brought them onto. He initially only brought 10 families. Of course, they left Germany with the intentions of going to America, directly to America, right, because they had been told, you know, the agents of Queen Anne of England were scouting around through Europe looking for people to go and settle in America as English citizens. And so they'd been listening to that. There were even special books printed to entice them to go, and they were told how wonderful it was, and there was the natives were friendly, and it wasn't heavily populated, and there was lots of wildlife for hunting and so forth. So to them, it was a land of milk and honey, and they were coming from a part of Europe. Of course, Germany didn't exist at that time, but you had all these little principalities, and you had the 30 Years' War, and then Louis XIV invaded. Sort of, it was war after war after war, and their crops were being confiscated, their homes were being confiscated, and they were just tired of it all, and they were looking to better themselves and to have a new life.
So then, Austin, if I can ask then, because you say you grew up in a parallel world, and what you're telling me is a parallel history, but it's a history that's very relevant to your community. So in growing up and in going to school, were you being taught the history of your people relative to where you came from, what caused it, and where you came to?
Absolutely nothing. We just followed the usual school curriculum, as you know, as everybody else did around Ireland. There was a school curriculum that was set out, and local history wasn't really touched on at all when I was a child, and which was an awful shame, really, you know. But now I can feel, you know, when I know my own family and what was going on, I always kind of think, you know, well, what else was going on in the world at that time, you know? And then if you hear about something else that went on in the world, well, you say, what was my family doing at that time? So it brings it all into focus when you know your own local history. Now, there was very little, if any, mention of it at all in the schools, you know, about the Palatines. Other than I mentioned, my father did say we came from Germany. That was about it, like, you know.
And there was no, like, the link from, and we're looking at over 400 years.
300 years, yeah, 300.
Is it what? From, 300 odd years. That, you know, that to retain a connection from, the 1709, to retain a connection for that length of time, it requires some degree of oral history being passed down.
Well, you see, they were they were a community unto themselves, and they didn't really mix with outsiders. After a time, they would have mixed with the other Protestant communities. So they would have mostly, initially they would have married amongst themselves. Later, they would have married amongst other settlers in Ireland. And up to my father's age group, that was the case, you know. And it's only in the last 40 or 50 years that things have changed and Ireland has become a totally different place. And, you know, religion had a big part to play in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It had a large part to play in it. And they married amongst their... They socialized, everything was, all socializing was done through the church. I remember a Londoner said to me one time, he married a Palatine, and when he came over here first, he said he thought they were all mad. He said, because everything was about, you know, functions in the church, and he just couldn't understand it at all, you know, because everything was organized around the church. And I even heard, now this didn't happen in my time, but you know, an evening's entertainment was to sing hymns while somebody played the piano in their one of their homes, you know. But that did change, and even in my time now, that had kind of had disappeared a little bit, you know. But we had things like the field meeting, the tea meeting. We had all these things that happened every year at certain times of the year. And we look forward to those. We've been compared with the Amish or Amish because the Palatines were very passive people, mostly passive people, and they kept their opinions to themselves and got on with their work. They had a strong work ethic, and you know, were very organized and kept, you know, minute books, and they kept agreements and all that type of thing, you know. So, yeah, everything was organized.
So, based on the little you and I have chatted, I know anyone who is going to attend, and again, it's virtual, on Sunday, and that's between 2:30 and 3:45 p.m. Canadian time, and that is the 27th of October. You can get more detailed. And as I know, in all these sessions, there'll be an opportunity for question and answer after you've done your presentation. And you can get full details again, and that is at bifhsgo.ca. And you'll get tabs there for the conference where you can register and get full details of the program. Austin, it's been a great pleasure meeting you and chatting with you, and fascinating.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We heard there from the main speakers, but there's another session, Expert Connect. Mary Lou, what's all that about?
So that's taking place on the Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. GMT. And that involves six breakout rooms on Zoom. And the breakout rooms are grouped or divided according to county. So the counties are grouped. And we're going to have two experts per breakout room, along with a facilitator from the society. So we have people such as Katrina Crow from Limerick Genealogy. We've got Michael Walsh, who is a professional genealogist. His company is Family Lines, and he's in one of the Ulster breakout rooms. And we have Kira Chivers. She's, again, a professional genealogist. Her company is Shamrock Roots, and she is in the other Ulster breakout room. So people will be able to bring their questions, their conundrums, and ask away. This is a Q&A interactive session, and people are going to be free to switch between breakout rooms. If they have multiple lines of Irish ancestry, they may want to visit several breakout rooms. And the recordings are going to be available. These sessions will be recorded. They're going to be available after the conference.
When you say after the conference, registration would also be available after the conference because it's virtual. So if somebody, it doesn't work for them over the weekend of the 26th, 27th, they could actually register and effectively catch the conference at a later date.
Yes, they can register before the conference. And then if they can't listen live, then they'll be able to listen afterwards. But if they don't find out about the conference somehow until after it's already taken place, they're free to register after the conference and then listen to the recordings up until November 30th. That's when that's the date until which the recordings will be available.
Brilliant. And again, that's at bifhsgo.ca. You will get full details there. Mary Lou Simon, thanks very much indeed for taking the time.
Thank you, Austin.